It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we're talking to a political science professor about the latest news on the Affordable Care Act and the proposal to extend badger care here in Wisconsin.
But first, we're talking about sriracha, the insanely popular hot sauce. It's in Lay's potato chips, a new Subway sandwich, and even, get this, in candy canes this year for Christmas.
Yum. According to our guest, the company behind this sauce is a bit unusual. He's here to explain how. Roberto Ferdman joins us. He's a reporter for Quartz. Roberto, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
So how big a success is sriracha around the country?
Well, we don't have a lot of numbers to base that off of because Hoi Fung, the company that makes the hot sauce, doesn't share a lot of them. But we know that they made roughly $85 million last year, or rather sold $85 million worth of hot sauce last year.
Just anecdotally, though, can you talk about sort of the spread of how it's sort of become ubiquitous? No matter where you go, there it is.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, especially in larger cities, but you see it on counters of restaurants. You see it now in grocery stores and supermarkets. You also see flavorings, as you mentioned. Subway has launched a new sandwich that incorporates sriracha. Sriracha is being incorporated into candy canes this Christmas, as you mentioned as well. So it really has reached a level of ubiquity where it's not just in supermarket shelves, but it's also on sweatshirts and T-shirts and the like.
Well, a lot of times we get new products that start in a marketing meeting or focus groups or things like that. But how did sriracha get started here?
Sriracha, as a sauce, is actually exists in many forms back in Vietnam. It's kind of like saying barbecue sauce. But sriracha that we know in the States is made by a company called Hoi Fung, which was founded in 1980 by a man named David Tran. He came from Vietnam shortly before then in the late 70s and has just experienced wild amounts of success selling this hot sauce in the States.
And he's a kind of an interesting character, isn't he? He doesn't seem interested in profits. He doesn't seem like he's out to make a quick buck, for sure. What do we know about David Tran?
That's very true. Most companies are, first and foremost driven by growth, or seemingly so anyway. Sriracha is Hoi Fung, rather, is a particular case. They've had more demand for their hot sauce than they've been able to supply pretty much since the company was founded in 1980. So they haven't advertised. They've kind of shunned investors. They haven't allowed anyone to invest in the company because, they basically have not been able to grow. They can't supply enough, the demand enough. And then on top of that, they're limited by chili growth. They use fresh chilies for their hot sauce. Most commercially made hot sauces use dried chilies. What that means is that they can only make as much hot sauce as the amount of chilies they produce allows.
And the interesting thing here is about David Tran, it doesn't sound like he came from this idea where he's going to be an entrepreneur. He was this guy who moved to a country and couldn't find good hot sauce, and he thought, if I can't find it, there's probably other Vietnamese immigrants. He just wanted to make something that tasted like home.
That's actually completely accurate. Originally, he made it because he couldn't find a proper hot sauce to use in his Vietnamese pho soup, nor could, it seems, many people in the L.A. area where he was living. So he started making it on a very small scale and selling it in local markets, and pretty soon he was producing much more of it. I think in the first year, if I'm not mistaken, he harvested 500 tons of chili peppers, which is not a lot considering how much they harvested last year, 100 million pounds.
Wow.
I know, it's quite a bit. And yet it's not enough. 100 million pounds of chili peppers is not enough to supply the demand. But David Tran is an interesting owner for many other reasons. Hoi Fung, the company, knows very little about where sriracha is sold. David, for example, couldn't even tell me in which countries sriracha is sold. He's handed it off to distributors. They have 10 right now who deal with distributing it, selling it in the States, but also elsewhere. On the bottle, there are several languages. There's English, there's Vietnamese, but there's also French. So it's one can assume that it's sold in Europe, but David himself doesn't really know.
I'll talk a little bit about the recipe, what's in it. You mentioned these chili peppers, and apparently they have to be fresh. And I read this in your article. He wants to harvest them apparently just a day after they're picked. I mean, that's got to limit production.
It has to do with a couple things. First and foremost is flavor. His claim is that it preserves the spiciness, it preserves the taste, but then it's also color. The time in which, or the time that passes from when a chili pepper is harvested to when it's processed will affect whether it's red or more orange in color. So processing them within a day of picking them is essential to keeping sriracha's, you know, like strong red color, which is so, I think, emblematic of the brand and of the bottle.
One of the weird things about the Hoi Fung as a business, usually, if I remember my basic economics, if there's a lot of demand and you can't keep up with supply, you raise your price. He evidently doesn't raise his wholesale price?
He hasn't. So until this past week when Marketplace interviewed him and broke what he claims was the, or what they claim is the wholesale price of sriracha, he hadn't even shared how much he was selling his hot sauce for. It seems as though he's been selling it for about $2 for the 28-ounce bottle, and then it's been marked up another $2 or $3. But you're very right. In fact, he said that when he originally started selling it, he was selling it for $1.75. So it's gone up 25 cents.
And yet, he sounds like he's doing okay. Well, I want to see if you can settle a debate here in the office for us. We have, ever since we decided to cover this, been talking about how the heck you pronounce sriracha. I used to say sriracha, and according to some food blogs, I'm right. But according to everyone else, including, you know, Rob over here, I guess you call it rooster sauce, though.
Yeah.
But it's sriracha. Can you settle the debate? How do you pronounce it?
I pronounce it sriracha. Unfortunately, the debate hasn't been entirely settled. If you scour the internet a bit, and if you read mainstream news, there seems to be a disagreement as well. So I don't really have the power to tell you whether you're wrong or right, only that I pronounce it sriracha.
Okay.
Well, here's the important question. I assume you use this condiment since you wrote about it. Maybe I'm wrong. What is your favorite way to consume sriracha or sriracha or rooster sauce?
There's a bottle sitting to the right of me on my desk, so I definitely consume it. It's about half full, and I bought it not long ago. I use sriracha with my breakfast every morning, which is usually a breakfast wrap with eggs.
Okay, good. I'm glad it's not oatmeal. I think that would have been pushing it for me.
Lucky Charms with sriracha.
I haven't tried that.
There is a new cereal. I can see it now. All right. Well, lots of tasty ideas there for us. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That was Roberto Ferdman, reporter for Quartz.
Coming up next, a look at today's big announcements on healthcare. On the one hand, from President Obama. On the other, from Governor Walker.
This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll look at why new office construction isn't bouncing back during the economic recovery and what that says about our economy and the way Americans use office space today.
First, lots of news in the healthcare front today. In a press conference this morning, President Obama announced plans to allow insurance companies to continue offering health plans that had previously been canceled under the Affordable Care Act.
And Governor Walker addressed the media today about his healthcare agenda just a day after it was announced that only about 900 Wisconsin residents had signed up through the federal exchanges.
Joining us now to make sense of all this is Ed Miller, a professor of political science at UW Stevens Point. Ed, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with President Obama's announcement that he'll encourage insurance companies for the time being to continue selling plans that were supposed to have been canceled. Now, is this going to help contain some of the damage to the White House?
Well, it may. I mean, there was some political opposition that was emerging in the Congress. There were a couple bills. The main bills one is by Fred Upton, which they may still vote on in the House. He's a Republican in Michigan, which would allow insurers to continue this to sell these policies. In the Obama announcement would not. So in other words, if you have a policy that is a substandard policy that is below the Affordable Care Act requirement, you could keep it for 1 year, But under the Upton bill, they would have to, they could, not wouldn't have to, but they could continue to sell these policies. And that's one of the major differences.
Now, President Obama, in speaking today, he was sort of owning up, taking responsibility for some of the difficulties with the rollout. He sort of said in so many words, we bungled it, and used the phrase, I think, we're going to keep chipping away at the problems. I don't know, if you're listening there and you're seeing these difficulties, people having signing up, the low amount, the low numbers of people signing up, did what he said reassure you?
Well, I mean, whether he reassures me, I do know that they're working on it, obviously. I mean, there's been so much talked about it. The problem, one of the problems of signing up has not been the concept of exchanges, because we've had exchanges before. I mean, Massachusetts is only one, but we've had other states that have used a similar kind of exchange. It's just technologically to do it through the website. Posed a problem because of seems like a lower idea, but simply problems of coding. And as a result, the website doesn't work very well. But according to what I've read, the website is working better than it had. But they say by the end of November, it's supposed to be so-called fixed. I doubt that it'll be fixed, but it will work better and more people will sign up. The other thing is you could sign up in other ways, but anytime there's this kind of rollout, whether it's this or it's the drug benefit when that took place, or in Massachusetts when they started with the exchanges, there's always a much smaller number than anticipated at first doing it. People tend to delay doing it. So, I mean, one is the technological thing of the website. The other part is simply people delay.
Okay, so that was a big part of what we heard yesterday, that there was just a fraction of the people expected and that the White House had projected to sign up for actually did sign up or were able to sign up. So are you saying that maybe that would have been par for the course even if the website was working as it should?
Right, I would say. Well, not, I mean, you know, their numbers were about 106,000 people signed up through the federal and the state exchanges. They had anticipated 500,000, so you know, it's a much smaller number. But I think the exchange is not working did inhibit some people. So it would have been a higher figure, but it's still, I doubt that it would have been the 500,000 that some people thought.
So why did the White House, put that projected number out there? Should they have lowballed it and made themselves look better?
They probably should have put a lower number out there. They were basing it upon the number of individuals who qualified for the exchange, based upon their estimation. And, in Wisconsin, for example, for those who qualify for the market exchange, it is almost 500,000 just in Wisconsin. The Kaiser Family Foundation estimates 482,000 just in Wisconsin qualify for the exchange, of which about 301,000 qualify for tax credits if they purchase their health insurance on the exchange. So, given that Wisconsin is almost 500,000, nationally 500,000 is nothing.
Now, you were describing the website failure as a failure of coding, and that once that was up and running, people will be signing up. Maybe they've been postponing it, but there has been a political price to pay for the Obama administration. How big of a hit is this, do you think?
Oh, I think it's a problem. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a political price in terms of the fact is that, people are more skeptical of how this works, or will it work kind of thing. However, it hasn't moved the figure at all in terms of those who, support the act itself. So that really hasn't changed. Recent figures show that only about a third of the people polled believe either it should be either the law should be replaced or totally repealed. Only about a third. And if you look into that third, only about 25% of the people want it totally repealed. So still there's an overwhelming support for the concept of the Affordable Care Act. Actually, about 25%, about a quarter of the people want it expanded when you look at the public opinion data.
So you think that the fact that it didn't roll out all shiny and perfectly working is not going to make the law more vulnerable? You've got Speaker Boehner saying, throw it out. It doesn't work. It's never going to work. Let's just call the whole thing off. Does it make the law vulnerable, or is this just some bumps in the road?
I think it's bumps in the road. I don't think it makes the law vulnerable. I think what could make the law vulnerable is, of course, we don't know. I mean, they've estimated it, but is how well this comes out in terms of, this is all private insurance companies. This is not the government running this, in terms of the insurance. And so how well this, people who are younger people, and that's why they were concerned about younger people, that younger people who have less health needs sign up for these individual policies so that actuarially they will be able, the insurance companies will be able to make money on selling this insurance. Because this has been, these are all private insurance. So I think not working to me would say that, look, they've got tremendous health expenses to pay out and they're not getting enough in premium.
Now, Republicans and Democrats have been frustrated. Republicans, I guess, now are calling the Democratic senators up for re-election in 2014, the Obamacare dozen, suggesting that they will be targeted expressly through that, and maybe they'll be more vulnerable. Do you think that within his own party, Obama is in trouble?
No, I don't think these are people in trouble. I mean, based upon that, for the simple reason is that, as I mentioned, there's such a small percentage of people that are actually against the act itself. That's first. And lots of people have benefits. There's a lot of benefits that have already occurred from the act. It's not just this. People under 26 can stay on their parents' plan. Pre-existing conditions for kids are already cannot be denied. And for adults in 2014, Medicare tremendously expanded in terms of preventative care. So all of these are essentially approved by the people. People like these things. So when you go down to the individual benefits, they like them. And the second thing is 2014 is some time off. And so I think that all this will be working much better, at least hopefully, by 2014.
Well, meanwhile, let's flip over here to Wisconsin. Just a few hours ago, Governor Walker announced that he's pushing back his plans to shift thousands off Badger Care by 3 months, looking at healthcare.gov's failures based on that. So what do we know so far about the details of that plan?
That's a problem. Because what he's doing is, although, people, there were about 77,500 was the estimate of people who will be eliminated from the Badger Care program. Those individuals those individuals will have to go into the exchanges. Those are the individuals who can, as you just mentioned, stay on Badger Care for a few more months. That isn't the problem. The main problem is that there's 80,000 people who would normally have gone on Badger Care. These typically are adults without children who would go on Badger Care because they're under the federal poverty line based upon what was passed by the legislature. Those 80,000 now will not be allowed to go on Badger Care. Because of the fact is that that's where he's getting the money to support the others. In fact, is if he allowed those 80,000 to go on to Badger Care, then those 80,000 to go on the Badger Care, then 100% of their cost would be picked up by the federal government. Interestingly enough, so then the question is, what happens to these 80,000? Well, these 80,000 people cannot participate in the exchanges because they're under the federal poverty line. And the way the law was designed, you can only participate in the exchanges to get a credit. In other words, you can get some coverage by the federal government in terms of, finances. This is the subsidy if you're over the federal poverty line. So they're sort of in no man's land.
Well, right now we're talking with UW-Stevens Point political scientist Ed Miller about the latest health care news, and we want to hear from you. President Obama spoke today, talked about extending the options for a few months for some people with their existing plans, and we're hearing about new changes here in Wisconsin as well. Let us know what you think.
Do you think these steps from President Obama and Governor Walker are going in the right direction? What would you like to see happen at either the federal level or the state level, or do you have questions about the latest news on the Affordable Care Act, you can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can always email us, talk@WPR.org, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll take your calls coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with UW-Stevens Point political scientist Ed Miller, talking about tweaks being made to health care in Wisconsin and at the federal level. Both President Obama and Scott Walker spoke on some changes that they're making today. You could join in, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. What do you think about the rocky rollout of the Affordable Care Act? Do you think it's just a short-term hitch or a long-term problem? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we will go back to the phones now as we talk to Ed Miller. The first, our caller is John from Windsor. Hi, John. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks. Well, I think that this is a very unfortunate for the state of Wisconsin. We were working towards a really good exchange in the state of Wisconsin, and when Governor Walker was elected, unfortunately, he took the partisan position, and he still does, that he wants Obama to not succeed. He stopped the work on that, and if you take a look, the states that are being successful are the ones that are running local exchanges. I think the Obama administration made a mistake by extending the time limit in which states had to make a decision about whether they wanted to join the exchange or not. That gave them one month less to actually work on developing an exchange when they knew those states were not going to go in. And as far as the Medicaid stuff, you know, this is a big political thing. Walker is cutting people off of Medicaid, and he's trying to blame the president for that. And I wonder what the professor has to say.
All right. Thank you so much for the call, John. And what do you think, tactical error there?
Well, yeah, what John says is correct, that the state exchanges seem to be working better than the federal exchange. And Wisconsin had a head start. We were supposed to be a demonstration state, and we'd received some early grants and we had progressed in developing the state exchange. And then we pulled out of it, and we had to pay the money back. But anyway, the state exchanges are working better. One of the problems with some of the state exchanges, they're having some connectivity problem because they have to check, you know, whether somebody's actually qualified for the federal subsidy. And so it's got to check with the IRS, and so there's got to be some code of conductivity there of the software. But yes, we would have done better with their own state exchanges, quite clearly.
I mean, that makes sense in the rearview mirror, but going in, had Wisconsin or any other state reason to believe that the system would be this problematic?
Right. Wisconsin, we would have known that this was problematic, but we were sort of ahead of the curve in developing the exchange. So we would have had an exchange. But no, you're right. We wouldn't have known that the federal one. But the advantage of having the state exchange was that we could also determine other kinds of conditions. For example, there are some minimum requirements that insurance policies must cover, and some of the states have determined other things that must be covered. Some states have decided that allowing insurance companies to charge more for smoking, which they're allowed to under the ACA, they didn't want to do that to penalize these individuals on their state exchanges. I mean, whether we should have done it or not is another question, but we didn't have that as an option. But states had options. But if you go into the federal exchange, you don't have the options.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, John. And let's go next to Don in Norwalk. Hi, Don.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Say, my question is just, I'm a little confused. The 90,000 or so people that are supposed to be dropped off of Badger Care, I thought that the federal structure was supposed to make it easier for uninsured people, you know, people in the poverty level and stuff who don't have, never had insurance to get covered. So why wouldn't the ex-Badger Care people be able to be covered by the federal plan?
Well, the individuals who were thrown off who will be thrown off now they've been extended, the state exchange, Badger Care, they will be able to be covered under. Now this is not the new people who are not covered. This is the other people that he's keeping on for a while. They would be able to go into exchange and buy insurance. The problems with that are, one is that they may not be able to afford it. Some may have enough subsidy that to cover virtually their entire cost. But there's other people who will not have enough of a subsidy, and they will have difficulty even buying a policy on the exchange because of simply financial circumstances. The other thing is that some of the benefits that they have on Badger Care, they will not have on buying the individual policy on the exchange, and most notably, dental care. So dental care is not included except for children as a federal required benefit. And so under Badger Care, they do have the dental benefit, but they will not have the dental benefit from virtually every policy that they buy unless the policy decides to include it. But there's no federal requirement that they do. The other people, these are individuals without children. Those individuals would be below the poverty line because Wisconsin did cover up to twice the poverty line. Now we're only covering up to the poverty line. And so these individuals who are under the poverty line who would normally be covered by Badger Care, being added to Badger Care, now will not be able to be covered.
These are people without dependents, right?
These are people without dependents. And some were covered and some were waiting to be covered because we had a waiting list to get on Badger Care for these individuals. So some of them haven't been covered. But they will not be able to participate in the exchanges because they're under the poverty line.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Don. And Donna, let's go to you and one more quick call from Prairie du Chien. Hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm a 53-year-old mother of 15-year-old twins. I've been living on $104.20 a week for a year and a half. I've filed for Social Security. I don't know if I will get it, but I am one of those people that are going to be in that said crack loophole. And as of April, I won't even know if I will have a place to live. I don't know what am I supposed to do. I wouldn't even be able to afford the new insurance that's come out. You know, I can't work. What do we do?
Well, Don, I wish you all the best. And do you have any advice for her?
Sorry to hear that. I mean, you will be able to stay because you have children. You will be able to stay on the Badger Care. I mean, assuming he's calling a special session in the legislature
until April.
Until April. But after that, you would have to go into the exchanges and see if you can buy a policy that would fit your needs. Now, the lower the income, as long as you're over the poverty line. And I wasn't sure about that. But as long as you're over the poverty line and you can go into the exchanges, based upon a very low income, you will receive greater federal government subsidies. Whether that's enough, I can't tell you. And that's one of the problems of doing this. For some of these people, there's not going to be enough of a subsidy that they can afford the policy.
All right. Well, thanks, Donna, and good luck to you. And our last question here, you know, we're about a year out from a gubernatorial election here in Wisconsin. Is healthcare going to be a big factor in that election?
I think it will be a factor, and I think the one of the biggest factors is not taking the federal government's 100% coverage of the citizens of Wisconsin. And why wouldn't we take the 100% when the federal government's paying everything? When normally under Medicaid in Wisconsin, the federal government picks up 58%, and I think that will be an issue in the election.
All right. Well, Ed, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Ed Miller is a professor of political science at UW Stevens Point.
Coming up next, we'll try and answer the question, has America reached peak office? Our guest says office construction used to be a sign of economic recovery, but the old rules may not apply anymore.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Our next guest says the construction of office towers and suburban office parks in America has not made a significant comeback in the current economic recovery. And that's a big deal, since new office construction historically has gone along with upticks in the economy.
And that's raising new questions about how economic progress is measured, as well as how Americans use office space these days.
Joining us now is Joel Kotkin. He's a fellow at Chapman University and a regular columnist at Forbes.com. We've got a link to his piece, American Cities May Have Hit Peak Office, on the Central Time Facebook page. Joel, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So as I just mentioned, office construction, it's been an indicator, even a symbol of economic recovery and prosperity. In the past, how important, how big a deal was it?
Well, you know, you could read the history of 20th century American cities by the tall office buildings. The more prosperous the city, the more jobs that were there, the taller and in many ways, often more magnificent, sometimes not so. The office towers, I mean, when you went, you know, you could sort of judge an economy by its skyline, and that is not the case anymore. Very, very little new office space is being built, maybe as little as a tenth of what we had in previous recoveries. We're just using less office space, and we're really finding other ways to put people to work without necessarily putting them in a cubicle, and certainly not adding a secretary.
I want to get into those in a minute, but here's an alternate hypothesis. If this has really been an economic indicator, if office buildings aren't coming back, is it a sign that the economic recovery isn't as strong as we might think it is?
Well, that's certainly one of the factors. I mean, the weak recovery certainly doesn't help anything, and particularly a recovery where, you know, the vast majority of the jobs have been, you know, very low-end service work. I mean, if you're getting a job in fast food or delivery, you're probably not an office user. So, certainly that's been part of it. But even during the relatively buoyant, looking back on it, early part of the last decade, there wasn't a lot of office space being built then either. And really, as I've tracked this, it's really been really for 20 years now that certainly downtown office space has not been added in appreciable numbers. And in this recovery, even the suburban office space, although growing a little bit faster, is also pretty anemic as well.
So as opposed to building new office space, are companies just trying to make do with what they've got?
Well, I think that's exactly what they're doing. And they're also realizing that they just don't need as much space. You now have, in many ways, computers replacing large numbers of the support staff that used to fill these companies. There's a lot less middle management, and they used to be a good part of this. And I think that also in some cases, in firms like IBM, for instance, they're finding that they don't really need office space. People are on the road. They work from where the client is. And so sometimes they have what they call hoteling, you know, where there is space that's available if you want it, but you don't have your own office per se. And I think this is going to become even more common as the younger generation, which is much more technically adept, moves into first the workforce and then into management.
Are we also seeing a rise in telecommuting? Back in the 90s, we heard how this was the wave of the future. Has that come to fruition?
Well, it's certainly happening. There's no question telecommuting is growing much faster than any other way of going to work, and continues to grow. Actually, in most American metropolitan areas, there are many more telecommuters, for instance, than there are transit riders. So this is happening. It's happening pretty steadily, and over the last decade grew much faster than any other mode of transportation. And I think it will continue to grow, particularly now with the mobile devices. And again, the young generation, you know, my students, one of them once said to me, why should I spend an hour going from one computer screen to another?
So is this a change in the way we think of office work now? Is there some kind of fundamental shift going on here?
Well, I think that basically people look at the office as something that you may need for certain functions, but you don't need for others. And it's not a given in the way that it once was. And even in companies that like in technology, they just use less office space. I was just looking up some numbers. San Francisco, for instance, in terms of tech-occupied space, was 34,000 people. There was 11.1 million square feet being used in 2000. That employment went down to 18,000. Of course, the office space went down. But even as the office space for tech in San Francisco has not really recovered, even though the employment now has come back, and it's still about half of what it was in 2000. So certainly companies, and particularly tech companies in particular, are just learning how to do with less.
Are there places around the country that are not following this trend, that we are seeing new office, either downtown office buildings or suburban office parks still springing up?
Well, there are certainly some places that are doing better than others. Certainly the strongest one is Houston. Oddly enough, the some of the biggest construction, both in terms of downtowns and even more so in suburban office parks, are energy companies, because they actually have a lot of workers and are fairly vertically integrated and I have been hiring and can afford to do it. There's this huge campus being built on the periphery of Houston by Exxon. But there's also an office building being built in downtown Houston. So, I mean, I think what you're seeing is Houston, San Francisco, there are plans. We'll see whether or not they ever get built for more office space. I think it's kind of the sort of frothy environment we're in. There's some office construction in the Boston area. Again, most American cities, not very much. I would say Houston and then New York, where a lot of it, of course, is the Freedom Tower replacing the old World Trade Center. What's interesting to me is whereas most of the new space in Houston and the little bit of new space being built in Silicon Valley are pre-leased, a lot of the space going up in New York and in San Francisco is not pre-leased. And I certainly would consider that to be kind of a scary thing.
Is this a trend that's going to stick around now? This isn't just a glitch, you don't think? This is a wave of the future?
Well, I would say not only is it a wave of the future, but it's sort of the wave of the immediate past. I mean, we now have really 20 years with only minimal high-rise office construction. Now, what has happened is there are many more high-rise towers. So when you drive around American cities, you'll see tall buildings, but most of them these days are more likely to be residential. I mean, downtowns in particular are just they're morphing from really the dominant business centers of their regions to kind of a lifestyle, an alternative, one of the centers you can live in or near. But it's nothing like what it was in the heyday of, let's say, the 1950s and 60s, when huge amounts of office space were being built. I mean, as a young boy growing up in New York, I remember watching Sixth Avenue, which to those of you who are not from New York, is known as Avenue of the Americas, when one giant tower after another was being built. There's nothing quite like that today, and I don't think there'll be much like it in the future. As much as, you know, some people would like to see it, I think it's going to be very, very tough.
How does this change the character of a city that this transition is going on?
Well, in some ways, I think it's an opportunity to humanize the city and particularly the inner core. Maybe inner cores are best suited to, as H.G. Wells predicted 100 years ago, for concourse and rendezvous. There are places where we go to hang out. Maybe this is where your art museum is. This is where your stadium is, where your convention center is, where maybe, you know, your iconic banks, law firms, government centers are. But it is no longer the employment center. In most American cities, the downtowns are less than 10% of employment. In some areas, like L.A., they're under 3%. So I think that you're just going to see an evolution on how cities work and how companies fit into the cities. And interestingly enough, I think when you look at the, let's say, tech or the creative sector, if you want to get into that, they are generally not people who like high-rise office buildings. They tend to look into like parts of lower Manhattan or areas that are or parts of San Francisco that are not your traditional downtown environments because they're a little funkier and the architecture is a little more interesting and there's more mixed use. I mean, it's infinitely more pleasant, for instance, to work on, let's say, Hudson Street in New York than it is to be in Midtown Manhattan. And
nope.
For the more creative types and for, you know, smaller businesses, these are better environments.
Now, the consequence for the economy here, when somebody builds a new building, somebody's got to build that building and somebody's got to manufacture the equipment it takes to build that building. Is there a trickle-down effect if we're not seeing these big buildings going up in other trades?
Well, I mean, certainly it could have an effect, but I would argue that you also have, because the population's still growing, opportunities to build all sorts of housing, everything from suburban single-family to high-rise residential. And that's where you're going to see it. You're also going to see a lot of increases in construction for medical buildings as we have an aging population. So, I mean, there will still be opportunities for building. And frankly, we're in the midst of what could be a very serious housing shortage in much of the country. So there's opportunities for building. It's just the office space, particularly the high-rise office space, and even to some extent the suburban office park, is not going to be so much in demand, and we ought to get used to it.
If the office spaces aren't a big economic indicator anymore, what do we look to for a sign of prosperity of a thriving community?
Employment is key. Income growth is key. How many, you know, obviously things like retail sales will tell you something. But I think you're looking more as the economy as it affects the individual. And the individual company, as opposed to, you know, how tall a building. You know, it's interesting. Today, the tall buildings in the world are not even in the United States. They're in China and they're in the Middle East, and because some of them aren't doing so great either. But the era of the high-rise office building and the ever taller office building is really past us in the United States. There may be again the occasional building that gets built. But I think increasingly, you're just not going to see as much of that. And that places are going to have to measure their prosperity by the prosperity of their people, as opposed to how many floors the tallest building has.
We'll watch the bottom line instead of the skyline. Joel, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. That was a very good line. Thank you.
I just came up with it. That was Joel Kotkin. He's a fellow at Chapman University, regular columnist at Forbes.com.
Coming up next, a look at surrogacy and how it's reshaping the modern American family. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.